to our first moose. We haven't done this before. It's probably going to be obvious. I would like to introduce Henry Mintzberg, who's going to run the session this morning. If anybody who's watching this live would like to send comments, questions, feedback, participate in any way, on the next slide we'll show you how you'll be able to do that throughout the morning. Welcome to our class, Class 6 of the International Masters for Health Leadership. We're starting the second week of our first module. So I want to turn it over to Henry, who's going to lead the first session. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Leslie. That's Leslie Breitner, who runs the program. And I kind of heckle, as you've noticed already last week. This is the second week of the first class, first module. It runs for 11 days of the sixth group in the International Masters for Health Leadership. There are 35 people in the class from about 12 or 15 countries. I can't quite keep track, from all aspects of healthcare, physicians, nurses, IT people, public health people, all kinds. We're calling this a MOOS. You may have heard of a MOOC. A MOOC is a massive open online course. It's these courses that universities, usually universities, run all over the world. People join up in huge numbers all over the world. And so we decided we'd try an experiment today, which we're calling a MOOS, a massive open online session, kind of just a single session. And if it works, we're going to do it again at the next module and so on. As I mentioned, the International Masters for Health Leadership. There's a sister program for business people, the mother program called the International Masters for Practicing Management, IMPM.org, for business people. So, if you have questions or comments as you go along, either email it to Leslie, leslie.breitner@mcgill.ca, or simply use Twitter at McGill, at imhl.mcgill. Okay, so I'll leave that up for a moment so you'll get that. We usually do workshops. People are sitting, as you've seen, at round tables. This is our sort of trademark, because they spend about half the time reflecting on what's going on in the class and reflecting on their own experience and learning from their experience. You can see these are people typically with 10 or 20 years of work experience in healthcare or related. They're from all parts of the world and all aspects of healthcare. And the key to learning is not to do cases about other people's experience. It's not just to get theory from us, although this morning you'll be seeing that. But it's to discuss around their tables and learn from each other's experience and reflect on their experience. And it's a very powerful way of learning. You're not going to see much of it today, because if we did a long workshop at the tables, we would exclude you. You'd have to sit there or at least watch what's going on at a table. So we may skip that part, but we'll do some other some other kinds of workshops. Okay, since we're calling this a MOOS, we thought we'd start with a couple of stories about cows that relate to what we do in this program. One is an ad from SAP Canada from some years ago, IT company from some years ago, and it shows this picture of a cow, and it says, "This is not a cow. This is an organization chart that shows the different parts of a cow. In a real cow, the parts aren't aware that they're parts. They don't have trouble sharing information. They smoothly and naturally work together as one unit, as a cow. And you have only one question to answer. Do you want your organization to work like a chart or a cow?" This is a question we address quite a bit in this program. We've already gotten into some discussion, and the next module gets into that completely. And the next issue about cows is an MBA diary, Walk Like a Cow. This is an article that appeared in The Economist, authored by one of the participants in our IMPM program, our current IMPM program, the International Masters for Practicing Management. And he discovered something very interesting when he was in India. We run in that program, we run a module in India. There, others are in Rio and Bangalore and the English Lake District and Beijing. And in India, they were kind of touring town and seeing Bangalore and walking around. And then they had to cross the street. Well, if anybody's had to cross a street in India, you know kind of how terrifying that could be. So the guy who was leading them around said, it's very simple, you just have to walk like a cow. And what he meant was they all had to huddle together and walk and just go and walk across the street like a cow, because Indian drivers are used to cows ambling across the street, so they react to cows. And so a group of people ambling across the street like a cow would get the right attention. Sure enough, they got to the other side unhurt. So that introduces a theme that's already been very strong last week in this module, and is very strong in this program, and is very strong in this room, and that is the sense of community. We talk about leadership in this program, but we talk more about communityship, which is that effective organizations, effective healthcare systems work like a community. And one of the issues we raised last week is about how healthcare can work as a community of communities. In other words, small communities that work as a worldwide community. And the response to Ebola eventually was the worldwide healthcare community working together to address that issue. So a little bit on moose and cows. Okay, just to unfreeze, to start off, a few half-truths to give us. I'm going to talk a lot about half-truths and myths for the first little while, and then we'll get into the nature of managing. First, we're going to do a few of these to unfreeze. Then we're going to talk about some myths of healthcare itself. Then we're going to talk about some myths of managing, and then we're going to talk about the process of managing. So the first myth is that we live in times of great change. Everybody knows that. In fact, when a chief executive of a company sits down to his or her laptop and says that they're going to give a speech, the computer automatically types, "We live in times of great change." Every management speech for the last 30 or 40 years, literally, starts with, "We live in times of great change." If we live in times of great change, how come they never change this first line? They keep saying it year after year. Was 30 years ago, did we live in times of great change 30 years ago compared to now? You know what? We always think now is the time of great change. I remember two famous professors from Michigan who said in the 70s, "We live in times of great change." He said, "This is really times of great change." They literally said, not like the war or the depression, "This is really times of great change." Can you imagine people living in the depression and saying that?
Why didn't we say it's a moving target, though?
It's a moving target.
Change, can I
use one thing? Yeah, yeah. Change is a moving target, and change is... And sometimes there is change, sometimes there isn't. So I'm going to ask you all a question, which is, how many of you, when you got dressed this morning, buttoned buttons? Okay, who didn't? So everybody buttoned buttons, right? I have one here. When you buttoned your buttons, did you say, "If we live in times of great change, how come we're still buttoning buttons?" Did you say that? No, how come? And what about when you drove your car this morning, if you drove here, or if you drove to wherever you're going? How many of you used an electric car or a Prius, kind of, you know, partially electric car? Zero. One. Then you only could have used one of two other technologies. You would have used an internal combustion, four-cycle internal combustion engine, which was in the Model A a century ago, or you would have used a diesel engine, which actually goes back before. So if we live in times of great change, how come cars are still using? I mean, if you look at that thing, there's been a few changes in automobiles since that thing, but essentially four wheels, place to sit, hood in the front, engine in the front, cover. It's basically the same fundamental technology with millions of changes, but not fun. It does the same thing. Your car does the same thing that car does. It's just does it better. So here's a quote from Scientific American. It's not too much to say that more has been done. Richer and more prolific discoveries have been made. Grander achievements have been realized in the course of the 50 years of our own lifetime than in all the previous lifetimes of the race. It is in the three momentous matters of light, locomotion, and communication that the progress effected in this generation contrasts surprisingly with the aggregate of process effected in all generations put together since the earliest dawn of authentic history. Scientific American is the best-known science magazine. It was in their 1867 issue. 1867. So, we don't notice all the things that haven't changed. And you know what? Most things haven't changed. Look around. Look around this room. You can sort of go look around this room. Look how people are dressed. Look look at Kleenex on the table. Look at drinks. There's a few iPads. Those are new. But what else is new? The clothing, the chairs, the tables, the lights. They've all been here for decades. We've been using all these things for decades. So it's not that nothing's changing. Of course things are changing, and information technology is now changing. The financial situation in the world is now changing. But most things are not changing, and we don't notice those. We only notice what is changing. The point of the matter is you can't manage change without managing continuity. And there's so much continuity around that you better be careful how you manage change. If you're only managing change, that's anarchy. It's unacceptable. So, people are human resources. Are you a human resource? I'm a human being. We don't think about it. We accept this as normal vocabulary. Apparently, the airlines used to refer to people, passengers, as self-loading cargo. Now, when you hear that, you're shocked. But you're not shocked by human resources. But if you never heard the term before, you'd be shocked by it. I'm not a human resource. I'm not human capital. I'm not a human asset. I'm a human being. We need to... measurement matters. I'm going to come back to that later, but so does experience. And in medicine, of course, there's this obsession with evidence-based medicine. But when I polled this group, when I polled all of you last week, there was more sort of support for experience-based than for evidence-based. Obviously, the two are important. But there's experience-based medicine, there's idea-based medicine, and there's evidence-based medicine. So, what's the point? There are no truths. All truths are half-truths. It's trying to treat them as whole truths that play the devil. So let me take an example. In 1492, we discovered truth, that the Earth is round, not flat. But is it? Actually, the Earth is not round at all. It's oblong at the equator, and it's full of these mountains and bumps, so it's not flat. If I look out the window here, this is Montreal. It's named after the mountain in the center of the city called Mount Royal, Mont Royal. And I look out this window, and it's not flat. If you're in Holland and you look out the window, sorry, it's not round. If you're in Holland and you look out the window, the Earth is flat. Nobody ever corrected for the curvature of the Earth when building a runway at Schiphol Airport. You know, they could have adjusted for, you know, a hundredth of a millimeter, because after all, the Earth is round. But the flat Earth theory works really well in Holland. The round Earth theory works very well for flying those airplanes. And the bumpy Earth theory works very well if you like to climb mountains. So theories aren't true. They're simply useful. And all the theories we're talking about in this program are not true. They're simply useful or not useful. Some are more useful than others. So some theories are very useful, like the flat Earth theory in Holland, and some theories are more useful in other cases. So, the conclusion is, seek simplicity and distrust it. So, comments, questions, arguments? Okay, so let's go on. Some myths of healthcare. It's a sort of second section. Okay, number one, we have a system of healthcare. No, we don't. Mostly we have a collection of disease cures, or at least interventions, and the more acute, the better. We do have other things going on, but the dominant part of the healthcare system is actually the treatment of disease. So let me read you a little spoof about this. It's a bit long, but it's worth reading. It's from a guy named John Robbins, and it's about health promotion over the cliff. Once upon a time, there was a large and rich company where people kept falling over a steep country, large and rich country, where people kept falling over a steep cliff. They'd fall to the bottom and be injured, sometimes quite seriously, and many of them died. The nation's medical establishment responded to the situation by positioning at the base of the cliff the most sophisticated and extensive ambulance fleet ever developed, which could immediately rush those who had fallen to modern hospitals that are equipped with the latest technological wizardry. No expense was great. It was too great, they said, when people's health was at stake. Now, it happened that it occurred to certain people that another possibility would be to erect a fence at the top of the cliff. When they voiced this idea, however, they found themselves ignored. The ambulance drivers were not particularly keen on the idea, nor were the people who manufactured the ambulances, nor those who made their living and enjoyed prestige in the hospital industry. The medical authorities explained patiently that the problem was far more complex than people realized, and while building a fence might seem like an interesting idea, it was actually far from practical, and that health was too important to left to the hands of people who were not experts. So no fences were built, and as time passed, this nation found itself spending an increasing amount of financial resources on hospitals and high-tech medical equipment. As the cost of training people kept rising, growing numbers of people could not afford medical care. The more people kept falling off the cliff, the more a sense of urgency and tension developed, and the more the country's money was poured into the heroic search for drugs that could be given to those who had fallen to cure their industries. When these people questioned whether a cure could ever be found, the research community answered with a massive public relations campaign showing men in white coats helping the bodies of broken children who had fallen, pleading, "Don't quit on us now, we're almost there." When a few families who had lost loved ones tried to enact warning signs at the top of the cliff, they were arrested for trespassing. When some of the more enlightened physicians began to say that the medical authority should publicly warn people that falling off the cliff was dangerous, representatives from powerful industries denounced them as health police. Finally, after many compromises, the medical establishment issued warnings. Anyone, they said, who had already broken both arms and legs in previous falls should exercise utmost caution when falling. It's kind of amusing. But you know what? It's not far from what goes on in healthcare. It's not far from what actually goes on in healthcare today. Health promotion. I asked an oncologist who does breast cancer surgery how much of the research money in breast cancer is going to researching prevention, researching cause of breast cancer, and she figured about 3%, she said. But of course, the people who have the disease are a lobby group to do something desperately, or the ones that have lost people are a lobby group for making donations to find better cures. But the people who don't have breast cancer or don't have colon cancer or whatever it is are not a lobby group for preventing it. And so we end up with this cliff situation, which is really not far from the reality.
The person that you're referring to, I think, is Kathleen Ruddy.
Yeah.
And she's online now, and she's an alumna of a previous cohort, and she said to give her regards, and she's watching the session.
Hi, Kathleen. That's cute. Okay. Lovely. The system of healthcare is dreadfully complicated. You know what? It's very professional, and it requires enormous skill to be a healthcare professional, whether it's medicine, nursing, physiotherapy, osteopathy, whatever it is. It requires tremendous skill. But you know what? The system, so-called, is not very complicated. Can you imagine looking at a system like this compared to a nuclear reactor. Somebody can take you into a hospital and explain what's going on pretty quickly. They can take you into a nuclear reactor for a month and you wouldn't know what's going on. The system is not that complicated. We make it complicated. You know, it's when we embed, the complications arise when we embed all this in the social, managerial, and political system. It's the social system, the political system, and the managerial and the organizational system that's complicated, unduly complicated, because we're trying to fix healthcare, and that's the next one. The healthcare system is failing. People in healthcare, there was a fellow in our class, maybe he's watching too, Peter Goldberg, who ran the ICU at a major hospital in Montreal, and it took about three modules till he got over this sentence, because he said, I'm watching people dying all the time, I'm struggling with budgets, I'm struggling with all this chaos, and you say the healthcare system is not failing? And I say, yeah, the healthcare system is not failing. We're living longer. And we're living longer significantly because of what physicians and pharmaceutical companies and other people are doing to enable us to live longer. So the system is succeeding in the fundamental way. Take a choice. You've got a heart condition. You feel chest pain at home. The year is 1960. You call your GP. He's over at your house immediately. Or she is over at your house immediately. They better get you to a hospital. They manage to get you to a hospital. The hospital takes you into emergency. They look at you. They do what they can. And then they don't say it, but basically there's not much we can do, and they send you home. Now, be in that situation in 2015. Okay, your GP won't come to your house, probably, but the ambulance will get there fairly quickly. You'll come into a possibly chaotic emergency room, except that because you have a cardiac problem, they immediately triage you and send you straight in. Within 2 hours, they've got a stent put in your artery. I mean, that's good, but within a day, they've got a stent put in your artery. They send you home 1 or 2 days later, and you're fine. Which do you choose? The healthcare system is not failing. The healthcare system is succeeding. It's doing better and better. What's failing is our unwillingness to pay for it. Because physicians, you physicians around the table here, are very good at, around the room, are very good at coming up with new forms of treatment that cost a heck of a lot of money. And you know what? I don't want to die because my hospital doesn't want to spend the money to keep me alive. So I am a huge lobbyist for pulling out all the stops and spending as much as possible to keep me alive. But when it comes to paying taxes, that's another story, because I'm not sick. Why should I pay taxes so that you, who has a heart condition, can get all this treatment? Or why should I pay taxes so you, who've got a very obscure cancer, can have $500,000 treatment? No, I don't want to pay taxes for that. So that's what's killing the system. Not the system isn't failing. Our reaction to not willing to pay for it is failing. So if the system is failing, or if healthcare is failing, let me tell you a couple of stories about failing. A couple of years ago, I was at a few years ago, I was at a party, and a friend of my daughter's, who's a radiologist, was going on and on about healthcare in Quebec. Just on and on and on. Finally, I stopped her and I said, well, you studied in the States, you did some of your internship in the States. What about the American system? She threw her hands up and said, don't get me started on the American system. So everybody complains bitterly about their own healthcare system. But do people realize? I was in Italy around the same time. And again, people were going on and on about how terrible the Italian healthcare system was. So at one point I said, look, the World Health Organization, this was the early part of the 2000 decade, I said, look, the WHO, the World Health Organization, did a ranking of countries in the year 2000. I think it's the last time they did it. How did Italy come out? And they said, oh, second. So here they were complaining bitterly about their healthcare system, and it was the second best in the world. France was first. And I'll get back to this in a minute, but you know what? Third, fourth, fifth, sixth, something like the next five were all tiny countries. like Malta, or I can't remember, just all small. All Andorra, I can't remember, or Liechtenstein, I can't remember which one, but they were all small. So the healthcare system can be fixed by clever central administrative engineering. Reorganizations, mergers, it's all a lot of fads and foolishness, so much of it. People sit in offices and reorganize the whole system. We just had this in Quebec, where they decided that nobody should run a hospital anymore. Instead of somebody running a hospital, somebody will run a hospital and five other facilities. You can imagine this person racing one day a week from one to the other, trying to figure out what to do. But a minister of the government sits in his office and reorganizes the healthcare system. The National Health System of England does this on a regular basis. They're constantly reorganizing. You know why? Because it's the easiest thing to do. It's a lot harder to get in the system and trying to figure out how to make it better. So what we do instead is we reorganize constantly. Or we merge. We take two hospitals, as this situation, we take a hospital there and a hospital there, and they're 10 kilometers apart, and they magically become one hospital. You know why? Because somebody wrote it down on a piece of paper. They drew a chart, and that became one hospital. But how do you manage one hospital that's 10 kilometers apart? So there's a lot of nonsense going on. Categorization, commodification, calculation. Everything has to be categorized so we can figure out how to pay the physicians. Right now in the Quebec reorganization, general practitioners are being told they have to see so many patients every day. And so they see all these patients, or they're supposed to see all these patients, but what's the magic number? I think it's 50 a day or something. What's the magic number? How do you know what the patients need? Do they need a fixed amount of time, or you just arbitrarily impose them? What about a woman GP who is raising a family and wants to work 3 days a week? There's so many complications, or three mornings a week. There's so much kind of manipulation of the system. Healthcare institutions can be fixed by bringing in the great leader. This is part of this magic of leadership, that all we need is the great leader and everything will be solved. But maybe we need more what could be called communityship and a different kind of leadership. So no mortal human being can possibly run a hospital. I'm looking for my notes, which are somewhere. Anyway, no mortal human being can possibly... No mortal human being can possibly run a hospital. You know, if I was offered the choice of running General Motors or running almost any hospital, I think I'd rather run General Motors. At least when you're running General Motors, you can say to people, jump, and they say, how high, sir? When you ask people to jump in a hospital, it's kind of like in this classroom. When we have the business people in this classroom and we say, coffee is over, we're starting again, they all come back into the classroom. When we do it here and we say, coffee's over again, three or four of them run out and get another coffee. This is what you have to deal with physicians as opposed to people in business. So it's not easy to run a hospital. So we're going to bring three or four people up to the front. And they're going to just make a brief case for who... Somebody has to run the hospital, clearly. We can't have a situation of running six different organizations. Somebody has to run hospitals. And so we're going to bring people up. Bander is a doctor. He's going to talk about why doctors should run hospitals. And Amber and Sophie are two nurses, and they're going to come and talk about not exactly why nurses should run hospitals, but at least... And of course, wanting to come up together means that they're much more prone to collaboration than the physicians. Sam is also a physician, but he wants to argue neither. So he's going to come up. And Uva is also a physician, but she's going to make a different point altogether, or maybe the same as Sam, who knows. So maybe we can just put four chairs up if you want to roll up. And just a brief statement about who should run hospitals.
Maybe all of you, of course, you can bring your chairs up now and we can...
Yeah, come up with a chair. Just stay seated so it's We can do this informally. So we're going to start doctor, nurses, neither, other.
Okay, to start up with Henry, physicians are human beings, so I think they can be led. So why a physician should be leading the hospitals? Physicians, most of the physicians, or all the physicians, are patient advocates. So what usually they targeted is patient quality of care compared to non-physician or non-nurses who has been the CEO of the hospitals. And if we look at the reason of having a hospital to start with is to provide the best quality of care. This is on one side. On the other hand, if you have non-physician and nurses who are running hospitals, may they have different targets or objectives. For example, budgets. How could they save budget? How could they improve profit? And all these are critical and important. But the first mission for establishing a hospital in any community is to provide a good quality of health care to those patients. Number two, most physicians, or all physicians, they know the obstacles that we see in a hospital. So they have a solid background. When you bring non-physician or non-nurse to run a hospital, they have sometimes no background on how does the healthcare system work. That could be a positive, but I think it's toward a negative rather than positive. And as we discussed last week, to be a good manager, you need to know what's going on in the ground. So physicians already knew what is happening on the ground, and they share a common language with members from the hospital. Where people are in the administrative field, they may not have that common language, even if they are active listeners, but they don't have the experience, or they share the same frustration or obstacles that physicians faced. The other point is, looking at facts and publications, indeed, the theory has been changed over the last decade or so. They believe that physicians will be the best people to run hospitals, but right now, a good percentage of hospitals has been led by non-physicians. I would like to quote a study where they look at the top hospitals in the state, such as Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins. Those hospitals are run, or the CEO are MDs. You could critique the paper in terms of how did they choose those hospitals and what terms of outcomes they were looking for. I think by being a physician, it does provide you a solid background for success, but this is not enough. Most of those CEOs who has been very successful in these hospitals, because they build up an experience and leadership, they are talented, and they entered and they took courses in leadership.
Thank you, Bandar. So I'm representing myself and Sophie, and we're a couple nurses that have collaborated and talked about our ideas around why nurses can make good leaders within a healthcare organization. And I wanted to first start off by saying that we both agree that it's more than just nurses and physicians that can lead a hospital, as well as allied health professionals and others. And I think certainly the experience has been that a nurse's perspective is definitely valuable when it comes to running a healthcare organization, and that's for a number of reasons. One of those being, first off, I can appreciate and understand everything that Bandar has said, and including his expertise and all of the things that physicians bring to the table are so valued, really, in terms of how it is that we can integrate that knowledge and experience and that perspective into running an organization. But the additional focus, I think, that is brought by having a nurse as a leader is that we don't spend 10 minutes or 15 minutes or even 20 minutes with a patient all day. We spend 12 hours. And I think this brings a little bit of a different perspective from the sense that as participants in healthcare, we're sitting at the bedside and we're observing the family come and go. We become a part of their life. We become a part of the life of the allied health professionals that we work with, become a part of the life of a physician that we work with, and really all of the healthcare team, including our managers, who, if we have good ones, we're not afraid to approach and engage with and interact with and suggest ways to do things better or look at it differently. So I'm not advocating that a nurse necessarily needs to run the healthcare system. I think they're a fantastic partner in doing so, and if they happen to be a leader, they do bring a valuable other perspective, which can really integrate many different aspects of the healthcare system and many different points of view. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Bandur, Amber, and Sufi. I'm Sami. And actually, in spite of the fact that I'm a physician, I'm supporting the idea that non-physicians, non-nurses should be running the hospitals. And before answering this question, I think we have to ask ourselves, what is hospital management? In my opinion, in the current practice, the hospital management now, important aspect is running it as a business unit. And also, we should ask ourselves, what are the responsibilities of the managers? And historically speaking, the CEOs or the medical directors used to be in MEDs, like a number said. But I believe this is now, I don't like to say this is a time for change, because you mentioned this, Henry. Everybody's saying this is a time for change. But at least in the physician, they have the advantage. They can address better the doctor's needs, the medical community needs. They can motivate the needs. But I think, in my opinion, that the non-physician, non-nurses, they have like a high level of administrative and managerial skills, and also maybe they have background and capabilities to run it as a business unit in a better way.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm going to address points that you have all made and be the devil's advocate on it. Bandar, you said that physicians have a background in medicine, they practice it, they're talented, and they're well-positioned to be a good manager. I agree, physicians as well as many other people are talented in many aspects, and much like you can find a great leader who's not a physician doesn't a leader make. So I don't agree that a physician is the best suited person necessarily to run a hospital. Regarding nursing, I agree that nursing is a very important aspect of the functioning of a hospital and the dispensing of healthcare, if we can say it like that. But while they're spending 12 hours by the patients, that's so much less time that's spent on other aspects of hospital functioning. And finally, Sami, you brought up the idea of a business person running a hospital like a business, which is a good idea because money makes the world go round. And you need money, you need resources, and a business person could probably come up with good ideas. But they don't necessarily have the medical, the human, the social points of view that are also necessary in healthcare. How do we reconcile all of that? For me, I find that we have to think about all the things that take place in a hospital. So healthcare, social work, research, education. Just because these things take place in a hospital doesn't mean that, let's say, a teacher is the best person to run the hospital just because education takes place in the hospital. My point of view and what I'd like to argue is that the hospital should be run by a collective, a board of directors, that will include elements from all people that are part of all these different parts together. You can bring in the point of view of the nursing staff, the point of view of the physician, the point of view of the educator, public health, money, research, development. You need all of it together, and it's very hard to find one person who's skilled in everything. So that's my argument, that we should have a board of directors rather than one person.
Just to add a comment, which is going along with everybody said here. I think having a team who include all the members that you guys discuss is important than who is the leader, because everybody's going to come from his point of view or his area of interest, and all that will add together to give better care for the patient. So it doesn't matter who is the leader, it's the teamwork, and I think that's what we have to work on to have a successful healthcare system.
Is it working?
Yeah. I would add to that, we forgot to mention also, the nurse who spent 12 hours, of course, is this pointing, the starting point of a nurse is to be at the bedside, but then she would acquire a more managerial ability, administrative ability. So she will, of course, develop her skills regarding. But the main point that I want to make is that the person that's directing all this, like a chef d'orchestre of a musical orchestra, he's not playing all the instrument, but he knows and he understands all the synchronicity of all the instrument that makes the music so beautiful altogether. So if someone is starting from a background and builds up slowly but surely the knowledge on different levels, then this person is able to have a vision of what would be expected from all the people that are on different level to compose this orchestra to make the symphony.
Just wanted to add one other quick thing. I actually think the person leading the hospital needs to be pretty much a saint, because if you deal with unions and the realities of the healthcare environment, and you know, you really need to be willing to be the meat in the meat sandwich sometimes. So in many respects, I think it also requires somebody with a real sense of humility. So I just wanted to add that.
I'm kind of closest to Eva, maybe. I think there's not necessarily about collaboration is important, and in fact, nurses are much more inclined to collaborate, as we can see physically here. Physicians usually work alone, and physicians make decisions alone. and physicians, it's one interesting thing about medicine is that every time a physician sees a patient, he or she makes a decision. The decision to do nothing is a decision. And it's a conscious decision, usually, for physicians. Whereas in management, whether or not to make the decision can be very confusing, and you can deny decisions or delay decisions and so on. So medicine is not like management. Nurses are more collaborative, but will doctors accept the authority of nurses? Business people know business, and they're probably more effective managers, but the question is should a hospital be run like a business? My conclusion is that I've seen failures of all of those, and I've seen successes of all of those. We're not picking categories, we're picking people. And there are physicians who are great, there are business people who are great, there are nurses who are great, and there are teams that do it greatly, and so on. So it really depends on the individuals, and teamwork, also the idea of whether a team functions well is also part of the same thing. So thank you. And I want to go back for a minute to categorization, commodification, and calculation. It's normal in medicine, and also for government and for HMOs or health insurance companies or whatever, to try and categorize everything. Physicians do it in their training, nurses do it in their training, and all the measurement is about being in categories and so on. The problem is that so many of the things that happen in healthcare either cut across the categories, go beneath the categories, or go beyond the categories. So across the categories would be geriatric patients who don't present a single problem. They typically present several problems. So they cut across the categories, and in fact, there's a requirement for more teamwork in geriatrics than in some other specialties. Beyond the categories are all those things that medicine can't deal with very well, like autoimmune diseases or what's it called, IBS, sense of bowel. That medicine doesn't deal with very well. But the interesting thing, one is beneath the categories. Everybody in class here has read an article called The Bell Curve, and you might want to look at it. It's from the New Yorker magazine by a guy named Gawande. And he talks about a cystic fibrosis physician who just gets better results than everybody else, even though he invented a lot of these techniques, and many people are using those techniques, and he does very well. And in that story, you learn a huge amount about healthcare. She's an 18 or 19-year-old young woman. Some certain lung reading was a little below what it should be, below 100, whatever that is in that case. And he's trying to convince her. He's trying to find out if she's been doing her exercises, and she said yes. And then he turns to Gawande, who was listening to all this, and he says, well, that's good, because if she stays at that level, she's taking 3 or 4 years off her life. At which point she breaks down and admits that she has a boyfriend and it doesn't work very well at home and so on. And so he says, well, let's figure out how you can do the exercises even with, you know, having a boyfriend. The point is, he went beneath the categories. He created the categories. He created the protocols. But he went beneath them and looked at the patient. Of course, legislation that says you have to see 50 patients a day hardly enables someone to do that. And yet the extra time he spent with that patient saves money. It doesn't cost money. It saves money, because the healthier she is, the less they have to spend on her treatments. So it's kind of worth bearing in mind. An expert is someone who knows more and more about less and less, until eventually he or she knows everything about nothing. A manager, you could say, is someone who knows less and less about more and more, until finally he or she knows nothing about everything. So what happens when an expert and a manager meet? Well, welcome to the hospital. That's what goes on in hospitals. The healthcare system can be fixed by more competition. That's a very popular position in the United States. If only there was more competition. You know what? There's too much competition. First of all, the United States has more competition probably in its healthcare system than almost everywhere else. The record in the United States is horrible. Highest healthcare costs by far, with results that are fairly average for a rich country. So competition isn't exactly serving well the American healthcare system. And in fact, the U.S. spends something like 31 cents of every dollar on administration, but that includes everybody suing everybody and so on and so forth. In Canada, where we have a more of a public system, we spend about 17 cents of every dollar. But the competition that we have too much of is not the market competition, it's the competition within healthcare institutions. It's people fighting with each other over new equipment and more beds, and public health having to fight with other kinds of healthcare systems to get bigger budgets and so on. That's where we need cooperation, and not more competition. These are kind of interesting. The big argument: healthcare is rightly left to the private sector for the sake of efficiency, or it's rightly controlled by the public sector for the sake of equality. So we have the U.S. system in number five, and we have the Canadian system more in number six. But you know what? Most of the hospitals in the United States and almost all the hospitals in Canada are neither private nor public. They're not private, they're not public. They're not owned by private investors, and they're not owned by the government. About 70% of hospitals in the U.S. are called voluntary, and they're non-owned. Nobody owns them. Or our church might own them, something like that. Or nobody owns them. McGill University, for example, is non-owned. Nobody owns McGill University. The government funds it extensively, but it's not owned by the government. There's a third sector, which I think should be called the plural sector, where a lot of the best healthcare. If you name the best hospitals in the United States, the top universities in the United States, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Caltech, MIT, and so on, they're all non-owned. They're not government, they're not private. And we ignore that sector. And in healthcare, we ignore that sector, even though it supplies the best services. Name the top hospitals in the United States, whether it's Mayo Clinic or I don't know, just Mass General Hospital, whatever it is. They're not owned by anybody. No matter which sector delivers the service, business provides the model for managing healthcare. Healthcare can learn from business. Business can learn from healthcare. No question about that. But healthcare is not a business. It's a calling. It's different. It's a different kind of animal. The trouble with learning from business these days is that business needs to learn from the best of business. I think, I'll talk about it in a minute, but I think most of business is off the rails. In the sense of executive compensation, in the sense of managing by remote control, managing through numbers instead of managing human beings, and all the rest. The nature of business today is not a model, even for business, let alone healthcare. And then measurement. Measurement has to underlie all progress. Measurement is fine as long as it doesn't mesmerize. The trouble is that it so often does. It's common to both in medicine and in management to be mesmerized by the numbers. Medicine calls it evidence-based, and evidence-based is fine, but there's a lot of experience-based medicine and management, the same problem. Scale is another problem. Let me tell you about scale. Canada has 10 provinces. Each province runs its own Medicare system separately. Prince Edward Island has better performance than the big provinces. It runs it more cheaply. Is life better? Maybe it's because life is better in the home of Anne of Green Gables. But it's also because it's a small system. And it's more human, and people can get to know each other. As I mentioned before, after France and Italy in the WHO assessment, we're a lot of small countries. So we need to run things smaller, not bigger, in a lot of healthcare. Work is professional because it requires nuanced judgment, which means while the costs can easily be measured, the benefits cannot. It's so easy. Anybody can save money in healthcare. I can. Give me an hour tomorrow, I'll save money in healthcare. Just decide who to fire, decide what to stop. It's very easy. But at what cost? So let me ask you something about efficiency. I'll ask you and I'll ask you. If I say something is efficient, tell me what's the first thing that comes into your mind. If I say a restaurant is efficient, what comes in your mind?
Speed.
Speed. Anybody else?
Service.
Quality.
Quality.
Anybody? Order.
Value for money.
Mm-hmm. Economics. You know, most people will say speed of service or something related to it. Okay? Not too many people actually say quality. Of course, the word efficiency means to get the most of what you want for whatever you spend. So why shouldn't it be quality? Why don't most people think quality? Okay. My house is efficient.
Comfort.
Which? Yeah, cost of heating. How many said cost of heating? How many thought about cost of heating? Usually that's what people say. They say cost of heating. Whoever bought a house because of the cost of heating? You buy the house because of comfort or location or something like that. You don't buy it because of cost of heating. How many times do you go to a restaurant just because of speed of service as opposed to quality of food? So why do most people zero in on speed of service? Do you see what's going on? People subconsciously, when they hear the word efficiency in English, it's not the same in some other languages, in English, when people hear the word efficiency, they think of measurement. They zero in on what's most easy to measure. Speed of service is most easy to measure. Cost of heating, which is completely irrelevant for most people, more in Canada maybe than in southern Italy, but still. Cost of heating is the most quantitative thing. So when people run around the healthcare system or any business system becoming efficient, they often cut tangible costs at the expense of intangible benefits. So you can walk into an emergency room and get rid of a bunch of beds, and you know what you're saving, or stretchers, and you know what you're saving right away. What's the cost of doing that? That's going to show up over time in stories and anecdotes, not in measures. Okay, eventually you'll measure the waiting time, and you know, 6 months or a year later, you'll do something about it. So we're obsessed with measurement, and it does great harm. Of course, measure, and measure what you can, but don't become mesmerized by measurement. Any comments?
I just think if you swapped out the word I just think if you swap out the word efficient for effective, you might get very different answers or broader answers.
Yeah, yeah. Now, not all language. French doesn't have a distinction. So in French, it's a little tricky to ask that question. But in English, effective is the right word because it doesn't bring you subconsciously to measurement. But efficiency does. That's why very often efficiency is a dirty word. You're bringing the efficiency experts, oh, those guys. You know. So you got to be careful. Okay.
Excuse me. Can you explain how that implying medicine again? I couldn't get the point.
Say?
Like using the measurements, we're measuring more than what should be.
Yeah. Well, it's actually here. Costs are easier to measure than benefits, usually. Okay? Take even a business situation like new product development. Okay? You know roughly how much it costs to develop the new product. Very hard to measure the potential market for that new product. Or you cut the way the government's doing now in Quebec, they're taking the people running individual units, getting rid of them all, and they're all, one person is supposed to run all these units, an old people's home, a community service institution, a hospital, and so on. Think of all the money they're saving. That's immediate. They know exactly what they're saving. What's going to be the cost of that? Tune in about 4 years. When the system, I think, will be in complete chaos. So costs are easier to measure than benefits. Economic costs are easier to measure than social costs. Okay, economic costs like how much your budgets went down. Social costs, who's suffering, very hard to measure. Economic benefits are easier to measure than social benefits. It's easier in a company to measure sales than other kinds of benefits like happier workers. Although that might be worth more in the long run, to have people in the company being satisfied with the company may be worth to you more in the long run, but economic benefits, like what profit are we getting now? Because we're ripping off your customers by forcing them to buy or, you know, conning them into buying things they don't need may give you benefits right now. Down the road, you're going to lose customers. So economic benefits versus social benefits. Okay, anything else before we go on to managing? Okay, I'm going to start with some myths of managing, but first I'm going to ask you a question. This is a lovely quote from a Nobel laureate in physics. He used to start his classes by saying, this is the course in advanced physics. That means the instructor finds the subject confusing. If he didn't, the course would be called elementary physics. So welcome to the course in advanced management, because I don't know what's going on. My doctoral thesis was called The Nature of Managerial Work, and I studied five managers, including the head of the Massachusetts General Hospital. Many, many years later, one of my last books is called Simply Managing, and I studied 29 managers for a day each, including about 8 or 10 in healthcare, ranging from a head nurse of a surgical ward to the head of the National Health Service of England and all kinds of people in between. And I'm still confused by management. But as I said in my blog, I do a blog, minsberg.org/blog. As I said in the blog last week, quoting Jack Welch, who used to run General Electric, if you're not confused, you don't know what's going on. So welcome to management. So we're going to do a little exercise here that takes a minute. And it's kind of fun, and you can do it there, too. I'm going to read you three quotes. We talked about a minute ago about orchestra, the organization as an orchestra, and the conductor as the orchestra, the head of the orchestra. So I'm going to, it's very popular to talk about management with that metaphor. So I'm going to read you three quotes about managers as orchestra conductors. And I want you to pick whichever you think best describes management as you know it. Okay, so I'm going to read three. The only trouble is after I read the first one, you have to vote whether or not you want it, even though you haven't seen the second or third. So, okay. But the other trick is you can vote up to three times. So you can vote. Okay, so you got that. I want to add something else about these quotes. They are all at least 50 years old. And you know what? You won't even notice because management doesn't change. Management is a fundamental practice that doesn't change. Medicine changes enormously. Management is a fundamental practice. So I'm going to read you three quotes. Here's the first one. Peter Drucker, the most famous management guy, 1954. One analogy for the manager is the task of the conductor of a symphony orchestra. Through his effort, vision, and leadership, individual instrument parts become the living whole of a musical performance, but the conductor has the composer's score. He's only interpreter. The manager is both composer and conductor. So how many for composers and conductors? You said nobody. One. Okay. This is usually the case because they know I'm up to something. because if we gave it to you cold, I'll say, of course, the manager is an orchestra. So let's try the second one. Sune Carlson, a Swedish economist, who studied managing directors in Sweden in the 40s. Before we made the study, I always thought of a chief executive as a conductor of an orchestra standing aloof on his platform. Now I'm in some respects inclined to see him as the puppet in a puppet show with hundreds of people pulling the strings and forcing him to act in one way or another. So how many for puppets? There's a speak slowly. We hold signs here saying speak slowly or speak. You got that? I should show you. Anyway. We have one sign that says speak slowly and another sign that says, louder, please. Right. So how many of you do not have English as a native language? Just to give people an idea. Okay, so it's about... How many of you do have English as a native language? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So 8 out of 35 have English as a native language. Not that we're against English, but it gives you an idea of what's going on here. So, puppet in a puppet show, and nobody wants to go that far. So the third one is Len Sales, an American who studied middle managers in the 60s, and he said the manager is like a symphony orchestra conductor, endeavoring to maintain a melodious performance. While the orchestra members are having various personal difficulties, stagehands are moving music sounds, alternating excessive heat and cold are creating audience and instrument problems, and the sponsors insisting on irrational changes in the... So how many for that? Oh, look at that. This never happened before. What's that? You read the book. That's true, but they haven't read the book. You better read the book, I think. So, right, that's true. I was wondering, because obviously it was knowing looks. I forgot about that. It's in the book. Okay, so the point is, it's not that grand, glorious thing during performance. I studied an orchestra conductor, wrote an article about it. He was the head of the orchestra, and he laughed when I read him. This quote, the second puppet quote, because he said, oh no, this one actually, because he said all of that has happened to him. And what happens during rehearsal, management is like orchestra conducting during rehearsal. It's not like orchestra conducting when everything is so smooth and beautiful and harmonious. And, you go like that and the radiologists come in, and you go like that and the surgeons come in, and the anesthetists come in, and the nurses blend in, and everything is just perfect. Nobody ever argues with each other. That's performance, but it's not rehearsal. And healthcare and business management is about rehearsal. So a few myths about managing itself. Management sits on top. You've all used that term, top management. On top of what? Seriously. In hospitals, management usually sits on the main floor, near the door, so they can get out quickly, I think. but in business, they usually sit on top. So the highest ranking manager the highest ranking chief executive in New York City, who's on the 80th floor of some building or whatever, is well below the clerk in his or her company in Denver, who's 5,000 feet high. So almost five times, six times as high as the chief executive in New York. In other words, top is a metaphor. They're top of the salary scale, yes, too much so. They're top of the organization chart, but are they on top of things? You know, the English expression, to be on top of things, means to understand what's going on. And if you see yourself on top of your organization, maybe you're not on top of what's going on in your organization. From this top come decisions and strategies for everyone else to implement. Most of you know about IKEA. And IKEA is the most successful furniture chain in the world, I imagine, by far. And key to IKEA's strategy is that they sell furniture unassembled so that it's cheaper for them to make, it's cheaper for them to ship and to store. It's easier for you to take it home because you can get most of it in your car. Then you assemble it at home. It's cheaper for you because you do the assembling. It's a terrific idea. Do you think this came from a bunch of executives sitting in a room? No. It came from a worker who tried to put a table in his car and he couldn't fit it, so he took the legs off. And somebody said, hey, wait a minute. If we have to take the legs off, maybe they do too. And that led to one of the most brilliant strategies in business. Strategies are learned. They're not planned. Okay? Strategies are learned. They're not planned. That's the important thing. In IKEA, you go into the warehouse. One of the few stores where you actually go into a real warehouse. Costco looks like a warehouse, but in IKEA, you actually finish shopping and then go into a real warehouse. So why do you do that? Because they opened a big store in Stockholm, and the first story is on the website, the second story somebody told me. They opened a big store in Stockholm, and they were inundated the first day, and they had a traditional way that you went in, you went to a table, you requested your order, and they had people fetching your things and bringing them to you. But they were inundated, so they just swept the table away and said, go find it yourself. You can imagine the chaos the first day, because they weren't organized for that. But that's where it began. And you know how long it took IKEA to take these ideas and build them into the business model you see today, which has been stable for decades now? You know how long it took them? Anybody want to guess how long it took IKEA to come up with that model that you see today with all its details? 10 years, 5 years, 1 year. No, you're all wrong. 15 years. 15 years. You don't get strategies by immaculate conception. Maybe Jesus was born that way, but strategies are not born that way. Okay. From everywhere come little decisions that can emerge into big strategies. Organizations need heroic leaders. We've had enough of that. Here's some rules. No, we won't bother with that. Organizations need engaged people. Quiet, humble, thoughtful. And that's been said already this morning by somebody. This guy ran Granada, a British television company. We're not paid to be nice guys. Our job is to wake up every morning and think of how to create shareholder value, more numbers. How many of the women in this room would like to wake up next to this guy in the morning? He's waking up thinking of creating shareholder value. God help us. Shareholder value is destroying business. Jack Welch, again, who I referred to earlier, General Electric, who recently, sometime after, called it the dumbest idea ever, was the biggest fan of shareholder value when he was making all his money. Because you're driving a lot of numerical gains that often are killing. Didn't kill General Electric, but it's killed an awful lot of companies. Because it's all numerical. It's all about pumping up the numbers. And anybody can pump, back to efficiency, anybody can pump up the numbers temporarily. You know, get rid of research in business, get rid of research, cut back on maintenance, you know, do all kinds of things, insult the customers, you know, push the customers to buy more and more and more till they get fed up and so on. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. I'm sure you've heard that one. That is sheer unadulterated nonsense. And it's common. Two of the most prominent Harvard professors opened an article on healthcare, Porter and what's his name, your friend Leslie, the scorecard guy, Porter and Porter and Kaplan, very prominent Harvard professors, wrote an article on healthcare that opened with this statement. Okay, well, whoever measured culture? Anybody ever measured culture? Whoever measured leadership? Whoever measured leadership itself? Whoever measured management? Whoever measured accurately the potential for a new product? Always get it wrong. Pampers was introduced as a travel product. Procter & Gamble never dreamed that people would use it at home. Okay? They always get it wrong because if it's a new product, who knows how the market's going to react. And whoever bothered to measure measurement? Whoever took the trouble, we assume that measurement is better than anything else, but nobody's ever proved it. So if you can't measure it, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, then we can't measure. We can't manage measurement, we can't manage new product development, we can't manage management, we can't manage leadership, we can't manage culture. Just a lot of silliness. I'm not opposed to measurement. I think we need to use it, but we have to be careful to what extent we let it confound and measure us. Okay, so anybody want to, you want to take 2 minutes at the tables and we'll ask you to wait and see if there are any table questions. Usually the workshops in this program run for 30, 40 minutes and are more involved, but we don't want to keep you waiting for 30, 40 minutes. So just 5 minutes around the table. Any table questions, you can go to the bathroom or whatever you need to do. Have a lunch, and or dinner, I guess, in Europe. Just see if there's any table questions. And it's just a set of individual questions together. We'll just take 5 minutes.
Thank you.
There are two images on your screen, if you're watching on the screen. If you click once, left click once on the mouse, apparently you can reverse them so that you can either see the that bigger or me bigger. I prefer the, if I were you, I'd look at that, not me. But as you will, I'm just joking. So, okay. So, questions, table questions. You have mics?
Actually, we are not a fan of measurements in general.
A fan of?
Of the measurements in general. Yeah. We are not a fan of it. But the question here, how to assess our outcome in general? I know that when we speak about measurements, in our mind, that mean numbers. But if we look to it by as a subjective measurement and trying to develop a new scale to do these measurements, maybe it's a better way to assess our outcome or our work.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's why we favor measurement, because we're more secure, we're safer. If we're in a litigious situation where you get sued a lot, you want to back up what you're doing and so on. If you want to prove to an insurance company that you've done all the proper tests or whatever, it also increases the cost of healthcare. But there are good reasons to do it. It's just that when measurement drives out judgment, then you have trouble, because things aren't always, you can't always assess things numerically. You've got to use judgment, and judgment is still in the dictionary. If you check, the word is still there. People have forgotten about it, but it's still there. And we need to use judgment too. We need to use experience. You know, people who are big on evidence-based medicine will say, yeah, but experience takes you to the wrong place. But sometimes measurement takes you to the wrong place because the measures are faulty or whatever. And experience, you need experience to oversee measurement in the sense of, okay, that's what the numbers say. That's what, you know, that's what comes out is what you're supposed to do. Does it make sense? And judgment used to say, do I think that makes sense? The other side of that is that when you use judgment, then measurement is the assessment of judgment. So people can say, yeah, that's your judgment, but look at the numbers. They don't agree with you. So it's always an interplay, I think, between judgment and measurement. That's the important thing, I think.
Just going in the same line, there is things that's subjective, yes or no, trust, patient satisfaction, worker satisfaction.
Yeah.
So I think we should still use measurement, but use it wisely, because when you look at performance, you look at things you can measure, which is how many patients comes in and goes out, what's the cost, and how it's the reflected that in the system. So you can, things that you can measure, and you have to show others what you've done so far, but there is subjective things you can't measure. I think we should still use measurement in a wise way.
So let me tell you a story. A colleague used to run this program. He interviewed a liver transplant surgeon and to find out what his performance was. And the guy operated on 10 patients. If I remember the numbers, 3 of them died. I think it was 3 died. 7 survived the operation. Of the 7 who survived the operation, one woman who had had an earlier cancer, that cancer came back because of the drugs she was taking, and she wasn't going to survive. That made 6. One guy needed a second transplant, so he had to have another transplant. And of the others, only 3 could go back to normal lives. Okay. So when he asked the surgeon what his performance was, his figure was 7. I think it was 7 out of 11, or 8 out of 11, because he didn't count patients; he counted livers. So the fact that somebody had to be transplanted twice still counted for him as 2, even though it was 1 person. He asked a GP, I think it was, who didn't count the woman who got the cancer back. So she had a higher failure rate. He asked the administrators in the hospital. I forget, they didn't count all the sort of problematic ones. He asked the nurses, and they said 3 out of 10, because they were more aware of the life implications for the people who had the transplants but couldn't go back to work. Now, what's the right answer? You've got a measurement there. You know, you open the envelope like the Academy Awards, and the answer is take your choice, right? So be careful about measurement, that's all, because one person's measure is not another person's measure.
I think offer that the hospital doesn't offer a product, it offers a service, and the patient comes for medical service. So the measurement, it has to be in terms of quality of service, quality of patient safety, for example.
Sure. Sure.
And they put the terms in case of this category.
Yeah.
The patient satisfaction, patient safety.
Yeah, yeah. And let me make another point. These things are ultimately what matters. But let me make another point that I made last week. All patients are people, and I think that's what you're saying. They're more than just patients. They're people. And they're people who either have their life improved and their lives are livable because of the intervention or not. So all patients are people. But not all people are patients. And in healthcare, we constantly talk about patients. But if you're well, you're still in the healthcare system because you're worrying about diet, you're worrying about exercise, you're worrying about avoiding diseases, you're worrying about living a healthy life, but you're not a patient. So all people, not all people are patients. And healthcare has to be about people, patients, and people. People who are sick, people who are well. And we forget that. So, yeah.
I have a question, so. If you achieved your goals, okay, successfully.
Your which, sorry?
If you achieved your goals.
Right.
Okay, does that reflect, like, how good manager you are or how good leader you are? That means this is a good, so leadership can be measured by achieving your goals and getting it done in the right way.
Well, but that assumes, A, that the goals were chosen judiciously, which is not always the case, B, that there's almost always a bias towards goals that can be measured, because how do you know if you've achieved your goals? How do we know if that surgeon, that liver transplant surgeon, achieved his goals when, four or five of these people survived, but only three could go back to work? So what about the others? Did he succeed or did he not? It's too easy to say, did they achieve their goals? Where did the goals come from? What's the measurement? And is it an appropriate measure? So it's I think there's too much managing around goals and numbers and not enough managing around judgment.
Somebody, one of our alums from class 3, Deborah Myers, wrote in and said, what about using measurement to meet expectations? For example, you could query patients or others, did we meet your expectations today? And actually, it was the focus of her final paper in the program.
Yeah. I mean, that's better. But again, you're never quite sure what you're getting. So if we passed around, let's say we sent a questionnaire to everybody watching this and said, did we achieve our goals? Did you learn? Did you enjoy the session? And so on. Here's a 5-point scale. And let's say somebody puts down 5 and forgets everything tomorrow and doesn't remember anything. Like they had a good time, but they don't remember anything that was said in this room. Is that success? Somebody else puts down 1, they thought it was all junk. Well, I don't know why they waited to turn it off. But anyway, they suffered through it. They put down 1. And 5 years from now, without even remembering this, they do something that changes their whole practice because they picked up an idea today, and they don't even realize it. So it's good. I think Debbie's right. Deborah is right. But also be careful of that. Be careful of that. That's all. It's better.
To respond to that, I think that using expectations to measure success or successful management or leadership is not necessarily the safest way to go, because we have discussed cases of patients, for example, who will consult and have their problem, like their problem is not resolved, so the problem is not really addressed or is kind of thrown under the rug, but they were very satisfied with the consult.
Yeah.
So that can't be correct, you know?
No. But again, just do what you can, measure what you can, look at the measurements, but get beyond them, get beyond the categories. get beneath the categories, get beyond the categories, get beside the categories.
So I think it's a combination of several elements. You cannot use one to judge if you have reached an outcome or not. I think, like, talking back about patient satisfaction, it's a small element of a whole, because, like, we have, like, a grading system of how patients are satisfied by the service, and one of the physicians ranks very high, but when we think about that physician, he's one of the physicians that does every single test, every single scan, everything. He's like, in the eyes of the people around him, other physicians, he's not one of the best physicians. Yeah. So, but patients don't see that part. They see, well, you know, he's kind, he talks nice to us, he gives us whatever we want, but in a system, he's not doing the best for the patients from a different point of view. So I think that element is important, but it comes along with several other parameters.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's their overall message. Don't get rid of judgment. Don't get rid of measurement. Don't get rid of asking patients. But you have to put it all together and try and explain it. You have to get under the categories. You've got to get under the obvious. And that's true of management of all kinds, whether it's business or healthcare. Okay, any of the other tables had any questions? Okay, so let's talk about managing itself. My book, Simply Managing, looked at 29 different managers, a number of them in healthcare, the head of a district in the National Health Service of England, the head of the whole thing, the head of a hospital in Montreal, that liver transplant surgeon was there, and so on. The image of managing, like the orchestra conductor, is controlled order. Planning, organizing, coordinating, controlling. Those are words that come from Henri Fayol's book in 1916. And they've really dominated our thinking about managing. And yet, if you watch managers, the first thing that becomes obvious is that they typically spend half their time with people they don't manage. They spend half their time with outsiders, whether it's other people in the company or the organization or it's government officials or the press or customers or suppliers. They typically have a range of a network of contacts that can be 50 to 100 people that they're in touch with frequently and many more infrequently. So planning, organizing, coordinating, and controlling describes none of that. And those are four words for controlling anyway. And this idea of the manager on top. The reality of management is captured by this phrase, I don't want it good, I want it Tuesday. In managing, you kind of got to get things done. Very different from medicine, where you can't say, I got to deal with this patient by Tuesday. You got to deal with this patient for as long as it takes to resolve their problem. It's not Tuesday. If you watch managers, and by the way, the head nurse of the surgical ward, pre- and post-op surgical ward that I observed, Fabienne Lavoie, a Montrealer, some of you may know her, was the most hectic of all. She was just doing one thing after another. I don't know. I was getting tired watching her, and she was doing it. I couldn't believe the pace that she maintained, and she's considered to be really good. So, but all managing has this, or much managing has this hectic pace, a lot of interruption, a lot of fragmentation. Managers don't do things in sequence. A managerial day is not organized like, you know, I'll do the big things in the morning and the little things in the afternoon, or I'll do it in some kind of order. It's just one thing after another. And somebody put it that way, it's just one damn thing after another. In managing. If you like that, you'll love managing. If you hate that, stay away. Action-oriented, get things done. Oral, very interesting. Managerial work is oral. It's not written. Managers don't read a lot, and they don't write a lot. It's changed with email, but not fundamentally. Managing is an oral thing, where people interact by talking to each other and meeting each other. And so on. So the manager is kind of in the middle of all these pressures. That's what managing is about. So what the managers actually do. Okay, this is just a little model. So I put a manager in the middle, who is those two little words are framing and scheduling. Framing is kind of strategy, and scheduling is scheduling your own time. And the manager sits between three places. Sits between the unit that the person is managing. Let's say it's the head nurse of a surgical ward, the unit, or all the nurses and people on that ward. Into the rest of the organization. For her, that's physicians, administrators in the hospital, and so on, budgeting people, whatever. And outside the organization, patients' families, for example, that are there, all kinds of other things. And managing happens, I think, on three planes. The first is information, that you manage by processing information. You communicate all around there. If you look at the amount of time a typical manager spends just communicating, not controlling, not leading, not doing the other things I'm going to talk about, just communicating, getting and sharing information, it's enormous. Okay, and then there's controlling, which is a sort of an information thing too, but controlling is into the organization. You don't usually control patients or your boss or whatever. And then the second plane is the people plane. Managing not through information, but managing through people. And two roles there. One is leading, which is leading the people in the unit. If you're a chief executive, by the way, there's no this, right? Chief executive is the whole organization or the outside. So leading is on the people plane into the unit, and linking is not talked about much, but it's a huge part of managing. The idea that a manager is a linker to all these people. They're negotiating things, they're linking, they're creating contacts, they're linking to customers so they can help sell, whatever. There's a lot of linking going on in managing that somehow gets ignored. And then the third phase, the third plane, I call the action plane, which is sort of doing and dealing. Doing on the inside and dealing on the outside. So what do I mean by doing on the inside? When Johnson & Johnson had this crisis with its Tylenol pills, where somebody had put some poison into some Tylenol pills, it was the chief executive of the whole company who managed that activity. He was doing. He wasn't telling other people what to do. He was right on the ground because he had a lot of experience dealing with the press, that kind of thing. So he was doing. And he was dealing. He was kind of negotiating on the outside, too. Managers, if there's a merger, chief executives will spend a lot of time negotiating that merger. If there's a major union problem, managers will spend a lot of time negotiating with the union. So that's the doing phrase. You know, somebody will say, Fabienne's a doer. Now, managers, in a way, don't do anything. They often don't even dial their own phones. You know, they get the secretaries and their assistants to dial their phones. But doing means getting it done directly. There's a wonderful expression in French, faire, which means to make something get made. And that's what doing means in managing. They're not physically, you know, operating if they're head of surgery, although maybe they're doing that a day a week just to stay in touch. But they're not doing it as part of their managing. And we'll come back to that in the afternoon when we talk about conundrums of managing. Hang on just half a sec. What I mean by conundrums, I'll talk about them later, is the things that are very difficult to do that are intrinsic part of the job. And one of the conundrums is, how do you stay in touch when the very fact of being a manager takes you out of touch with the very things you're managing? So yesterday you were a baseball player, and today you're the manager of the baseball team, and you're no longer pitching or hitting. Okay, so how do you stay in touch? Well, for the manager, it's easy, but when you go up a hierarchy of a big organization or a big hospital, you're getting farther and farther out of touch with what's happening on the ground, which is surgery or baseball or selling or whatever it is. And a fundamental conundrum of managing is how to stay in touch when the fact that you're a manager takes you out of touch. Now, you know, it's very popular in medicine to say, oh, him. He's not one of us anymore. He's become the director of professional services. He's no longer a doctor. Okay? And my answer to that is, good, then we'll get rid of that position. The physicians don't need any representation. Or we'll get an MBA who just graduated from Harvard. He'll be the director of professional services. Would you prefer that? Or an accountant? Would you prefer that? It's a ridiculous comment, because medicine needs to have major representation in the management of the hospital. And physicians who are doing that are contributing to the hospital. So you need a
Consider micromanager?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because you mustn't interfere, right? You mustn't interfere with other managers. If that's taken to mean you must never get on the ground and see what's going on, because there are other managers managing that, then it is destructive of the management process. There's a difference between informing yourself and micromanaging. Okay, I'll give you an example from a famous... I sit in the Cleghorn chair here at McGill. John Cleghorn was the chairman, chief executive of the Royal Bank of Canada. He became famous for doing things like this. He would drive to the airport to take a plane, and he'd call back and say, there's an ATM, an automatic teller machine, on such and such a corner that's not working. Now, why should the chief executive of a 50,000-person organization have to do that? Because he's saying that everybody has to do that. He's saying everybody has to be reporting stuff like that. And that's not micromanaging. Sure, there was someone who didn't look after that ATM, or maybe they didn't know about it. But there's a difference between meddling and simply getting informed. There's a company in Japan called Keio. I don't know if they still do this. They did various cosmetics and some discs for computers and different things. And they had a rule, I don't know if they still do, that every meeting was in the open. No meetings were behind closed doors. And anybody in the company could sit down at any meeting. So if a worker walked by and the executive committee was meeting, that worker could sit down at that meeting. If the chief executive was in the factory and they were having a meeting, chief executive could sit down at that meeting. Now, is that micromanaging? No, I think it's making sure that everybody, making sure there's a free flow of information. I agree that there could be a subtle difference, because if you're the boss, it's kind of like, well, he just said, you know, such and such, so maybe we better be careful. You got to be careful how you use it, but it doesn't have to be micromanaging.
For a manager, it's going to be very difficult to know every single details.
If it's...
As a manager or as a leader. Like, it's going to be very difficult to know every single detail. So that's an ATM machine. Like, I cannot just go through all these 1,000 ATM machines and know which is broken or not.
Absolutely.
If it's come across mine, then that's normal things to respond.
What he's saying is we should all be on the lookout for it. He's not saying I can do it all. He's saying we should all be on the lookout for it. Look, if you're running a bank like that with 2,500 branches, by going into one branch, you're kind of getting an idea of all branches, not necessarily everything. If you're IKEA and you go into one store, you kind of have a sense of how the place is working. It may not be the same in, you know, Papua New Guinea as it is in downtown London, but at least you can sort of expose yourself to that. The fact is that because it's so vast and you can expose yourself to nothing, and you expose yourself to nothing, then you're in trouble. And you need to be able to kind of see all that. The danger is not getting on the ground. The danger is not knowing what's going on at all. And to run a conglomerate, or these poor guys in Quebec who now have to run six different organizations, they can't possibly do much because their job is impossible. I use the term natural units, managing a natural unit. A hospital, a physical facility, is a natural unit. It's a natural thing to manage. Two hospitals 10 kilometers apart is not a natural unit. Okay? Managing a conglomerate with a company that General Electric is now cutting back and consolidating, getting rid of its financial arm and so on, real estate, because it's very difficult to manage a conglomerate where you have to know all these different businesses. Do you want to add something? Yeah. Okay.
Do you think the problem of management is more obvious here in North America compared to Europe? I mean, you spoke about the ranking of health system all over the world, and you mentioned, for example, the first five or three, they were not from North America.
They were the first 10, probably, or 15.
Yeah, I mean, is it because of the way of the management that here in North America, there are more horizontal way of or horizontal style of management, and in other city there are the vertical style. Is this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, you could say that the first book on management was probably Henri Fayol in 1916. Around the same time was Taylor. Who wrote about time study methods around the same time. He was American. But essentially, if you look at management in the last 30, 40 years, it's almost all of it has come out of the United States. A good part of it from Indian gurus who work in the United States, but essentially it's become an American thing. And yet, I think you're right. There's almost too much management. Or, you know, there's wonderful management, what I call sort of boss-style, entrepreneurial-style management. So you look at Google, the Googles and the Amazons and the Starbucks, and they're all entrepreneurial, essentially. Their founders are still around. And that's a style of management, and that's what you would get in many countries, the Middle East, commonly many countries. The boss is the boss, but knows the business intimately and sometimes meddles too much. But really knows the place. Whereas we're getting a kind of professional style management. I'm not a fan of MBA programs because they train people as if you can manage everything. You know, if you don't need to know the business. Harvard has like hundreds of cases where they're doing in the space of 2 years. How can they don't know those businesses? They think running a business is like doing a case study where you read a few pages the day before, and suddenly you're pronouncing on what the company should do. George Bush went through that. I don't think he even read a case on Iraq before he went in. So there's no professional manager. You've got to understand the context. You've got to understand the situation. You've got to understand what's going on. And I think there's too much of this disconnected management in the U.S. right now. So, okay. So we talked about this last week. Okay, yeah.
The question I have for you is, like, I needed a clarification in the points you raised.
Wait, you needed a
clarification.
Yeah.
The first thing you said is manage through people, not through information. And yeah. As you explained, you also said that the first job of the manager is to process information and linking and trying to communicate. So I need, because these things seem to be, you know, one affecting one to another. So I need clarification on that point.
Yeah, I'm not saying first, second, third. I talked about them in that order because information is closest to the person. And people is next step out, and managing action is out into the world. No, I'm certainly not saying that one of those rings is better than the other. I should have said that all managing happens on all three planes. You've got to do all. You've got to process information. You've got to deal with people, and you've got to manage by doing or manage action. So all managing is all three. There's no sequence that way. Is that okay? Okay. I'm glad you asked. Last week here we talked about the art and craft science of your own of your own approaches to things, and to what extent you favor art and creativity and novelty, to what extent you favor craft, which is experience, and to what extent you favor science in the form of analysis and evidence, and so on. Management is basically a practice where those three things meet. There's not a lot of science in managing, but there's some, and there's the use of analysis. I think too much often in big companies. Experience is key to managing, and experience is what this class is about. You're bringing in your experience and learning from your experience at the round tables. Normally, on a morning like this, you'd be spending half your time discussing things at the round tables, and we did a lot of that last week, but because of the people sitting in, we're doing it a bit differently today. And there's the art, the artistic side, vision, insight, all those kinds of things, imagination that we talk about. Okay, what I'm going to do is discuss these conundrums quickly for the outside audience, and then we're going to do a workshop, but we'll end the podcast or whatever it's called once we're finished. So this to me is the heart and soul of managing in a way. It's one of the chapters in my book, Simply Managing, where I talk about a number, there's six of them here, I have a few others. And I think these are what we have to deal with. And they're worded so that those of you who are more in clinical practice can ask some of the same questions about practicing medicine or nursing or so on, and others can ask about managing those things. And what I'm going to ask you to do at each table is pick one or two of these things in a workshop and talk about your own experiences with them. So the first one I call the syndrome of superficiality. How do you get in deep when there's so much pressure to get it done? This action-oriented, this interruption, this oral nature of the job. How do you get in deep? How do you think thoroughly when there's such pressure? And, of course, in medicine, it's very similar. If the government's putting pressure on you to see more and more patients, how do you spend your time seeing regular patients, seeing patients as you have to see them? The predicament of planning, how to plan, strategize, or just plain think, let alone think ahead in such a hectic job. The quandary of connecting, I talked about this a moment ago, how to keep informed, in contact, and touch when managing by its very nature is removed from the very things that are being managed. Okay? And then the labyrinth of decomposition, where do you find synthesis in a world so decomposed by analysis? This is again categorizing, right? Everything is so categorized in medicine that all the protocols, in organizations, there are all the silos, all the departments, everything is so decomposed. How do we put it back together? How do we, to repeat what I said last week, how do we make healthcare into a community of communities when everything is so divided up, so separated? The mysteries of measuring. How do you manage it when you can't rely on measuring it? And the clutch of confidence. I like this one. How do you maintain a sufficient level of confidence without crossing over into arrogance? This is a question for managers, and it's a question for physicians and nurses and everybody else. It's not only, if you're not confident, if you don't have confidence in what you do, I don't want to meet a physician who says, I don't have a clue what's wrong with you, but maybe we'll figure it out. You know, you want to meet someone who says, you're in good hands, we'll take care of you, we'll work it out. You need a certain confidence. But confidence spills over, or a manager who says, this is the way we're going, we're moving, there was the biggest move of any building ever in Canada yesterday, I think it was yesterday or Saturday, when the major McGill Teaching Hospital moved into a brand new facility. And you've got to be absolutely decisive about what you're doing. This is not a question we'll work it out as we go along. It's got to be worked out very carefully. But how do you avoid arrogance when you're so decisive? How do you avoid arrogance when you're a physician who maybe isn't sure, even though you're giving the impression you're sure? It's a tough line to cross. And the ambiguity of acting. How to act decisively in a complicated, nuanced world. Because you're supposed to take a stand. Managers take stands. They have to say, this is where we're going, and sort of think in their back of their minds, is this really, really where we want to be going? But you can't show that. So,
comment, okay. A question from the outside world.
Yeah.
Okay, shut.
Go ahead.
So somebody sent in a question. This is from Jim Hunziker, who is an alumnus from Class 1, and he's at the Oregon Health Sciences University in Oregon in the United States. And he says, in the U.S., there's a growing trend toward mergers and acquisitions of hospitals into large systems. These are being done for the usual reasons of scaling and the notion that bigger is better. Good or bad, this is happening. Given this, what can managers at the system level do that is consistent with your idea about effective managing?
Stop the mergers. I think we have to grow past. There may be mergers that make sense. Of course, you can't dismiss all of them. But you know what? Whenever there are closures, it's always the little place that gets closed, right? Not the big place. And yet the little place may be a lot more efficient, but also a lot more human than the big place. It's always the little place that gets closed. And often that's sheer power. The big place has much more political influence than the little place. So the little place gets closed, and we get bigger and bigger and less human. You know, we started building these massive hospitals until we discovered, what, about 700 beds was really about the limit that we could tolerate. And same thing with schools. We built these huge, comprehensive high schools, you know, with 3,000 kids or whatever it was, that turned out to be horrible. There's something about a human scale. So, Jim, how do you stop this? Or how do you manage within it? I.e., you try and maintain your humanity within it and try and keep the nonsense that's coming from the center where they may not understand things out while letting in the good stuff. But mostly this has to be addressed with a different view of scale. The economists, we're back to efficiency. The economists have always dominated this argument of scale, economic scale. But as I say, economic scale may be efficient, but it's not, often it's not effective. I wish I could provide a better answer, but stop it. So, just to close for the public part, I'm going to ask you to sit around your tables and discuss this. Pick one or two. Are you seated by the role you're playing in healthcare? Did we do that, Lev? Oh, because this workshop really needs it. We can't quit early, though. I don't think we'll screw people up. Anyway, let me explain. Sitting by your role in healthcare, each table will take one or two of the conundrums and discuss how you deal with it. What are your tricks? Competency sharing again. At the end, be prepared to share one or two of the best ideas that came up at your table. So that'll be the end for everybody out there, and thank you for attending. And Leslie wants to make a last announcement.
Sorry, we have one commercial announcement here. The IMHL alumni group is working on the next reunion conference, and it's going to take place probably in early April in Chile, and they want anyone out there who's listening to know that it's happening, and all of you in here, they are welcoming you and welcoming you to the larger IMHL community, and you'll be invited to come too.
So thank you for bearing with me, and I hope our moves will be successful enough to do it again. Thank you. All right. Now.